أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Surah 105, Al-Fil, The Elephant, Makkan Period. Title: The surah's title is derived from the opening verse which speaks of the people of the elephants. Period of revelation. The consensus view is that this is a Makkan surah. While keeping in mind its circumstantial setting, it does appear to be an early Makkan surah. Circumstantial setting. In the explanatory note in note 4 on
Surah Al-Buruj,
we stated that the Christian kingdom of Abyssinia had attacked Yemen and put an end to the Himyarite empire in retaliation for the massacre of the Christians of Najran in Yemen carried out by the Jewish ruler of Yemen, the Nuwas. By 525, the Abyssinians had established their full control over the entire region. This had been possible thanks to the assistance provided by the Roman Empire to the Abyssinians. The latter did not have a naval fleet. With the help of the naval fleet provided by the former, the latter had been able to penetrate deep into Yemen with its 70,000-strong army. Let us clarify that no religious factor was behind this collaboration. Rather, political and economic factors accounted for the alliance. Avenging the blood of Christian victims was merely a pretext. After having captured Egypt and Syria, the Roman Empire sought to remove the Arabs from the trade scene in order to monopolize its trade with East Africa, India, Indonesia, and other territories already under Roman rule. In pursuance of the same objective, in 24 or 25 BC, Augustus had sent a huge army to the western coast of Arabia, led by Aelius Gallus. Its goal was to capture the sea route from northern Arabia to Syria. The climatic rigors of Arabia, however, proved unbearable for the army, and the expedition was aborted. At a later date, the Romans moved their naval fleet to the Red Sea, which blocked the Arab sea trade. They were left with only the land route to carry out their trade. So as to capture this land route too, the Romans entered into an alliance with the Abyssinians and helped them establish control over Yemen, while also providing them with a naval fleet. Arab historians have recorded divergent accounts about the Abyssinian army that invaded Yemen. According to Ibn Kathir, it was led by two chiefs, Ariyat and Abraha. Muhammad ibn Ishaq speaks of Ariyat as its leader, with Abraha a member of the army. Both of these historians report a fierce confrontation between Ariyat and Abraha, which resulted in the killing of the former. Consequently, Abraha captured Yemen and persuaded the Abyssinian king to appoint him his governor of Yemen. As opposed to this version, Greek and Syriac chroniclers inform us that after the conquest of Yemen, as the Abyssinians started killing the local chiefs who had put up resistance, one of these chiefs, Asymphius, pledged both his allegiance and payment of the poll tax and so secured governorship of Yemen. However, the Abyssinians rose in revolt against him and appointed Abraha as governor in his place. Asymphius was a slave of a Greek trader who had, by dint of his shrewdness, gained the confidence of the Abyssinian army. The armies sent by the Abyssinian king to dethrone him were defeated, or he caused division in their ranks. Eventually, the king recognized him as his deputy there. Greek historians name him as Abrahams, and the Syriac ones as Abraham. Abraha is possibly its Abyssinian version. Gradually, he turned into a sovereign king, though nominally he acknowledged the authority of the Abyssinian king. He referred to himself as vicegerent. However, he was an influential and mighty ruler. When he celebrated his renovation of the Marib Dam in 543, envoys of the Roman and Persian empires and of the kingdoms of Hira and Ghassan joined him in the festivities. Its detailed account features in the plaque inserted by him at the dam. This plaque has survived to this day and is reproduced by Glaser. For details, see Sabah 34, note 37. After having established his rule firmly over Yemen, Abraha turned his attention to the original plan which he shared with the Roman Empire. His aim was two-pronged: A, to promote Christianity in Arabia, and B, to capture the trade carried out by the Arabs between the eastern territories and the Roman border. This plan had assumed some urgency on account of the confrontation between the Persian and Roman empires, as a result of which the Romans could not expand trade in any other direction. For achieving this objective, Abraha had a towering church built in Sana'a, capital of Yemen, called by Arab historians as Al-Koles, the Arabic version of the original Greek Ekklesia. In the words of Muhammad ibn Ishaq, after its construction, he informed the Abyssinian king that it was his resolve to divert the Arabs' devotion to the Kaaba to the new church. Ibn Kathir states that he publicly announced the same in Yemen and issued a proclamation to that effect. So doing, he intended to provoke the Arabs into taking action that would provide him with the pretext he needed to invade Mecca and demolish the Kaaba. Muhammad ibn Ishaq reports that an Arab felt so outraged at this proclamation that he somehow entered the church and defecated inside it. Ibn Kathir ascribes this act to a member of the Quraysh. Muqatil ibn Sulaiman's version is that some Quraysh youths set this church on fire. In view of Abraha's provocative proclamation, any of the above incidents was to be expected. It is not at all surprising that in the Jahiliyyah period, some Quraysh youths may have burnt down the church or that some Arab may have defecated inside it. It is also likely that Abraha may have planted someone to damage the church, thereby legitimizing his invasion of Mecca. By destroying the Quraysh and thus placing all the Arabs under his awe, he could easily achieve both of his objectives. Whatever be the case, when Abraha received the report about the desecration of the church at the hands of some devotee of the Kaaba, he vowed to demolish the same. In 570 or 571, Abraha proceeded towards Mecca leading a 60,000 strong army which had 9 or 13 elephants as part of its force. On the way, he was first confronted by a Yemeni chief, Dhu-Tafr. He, however, was quickly defeated and arrested. In the Qatham region, Abraha's army was challenged by an Arab tribal chief, Nufail ibn Habib. He, too, could not match Abraha's strong and resourceful army and was also arrested. To save his own life, though, he agreed to act as a guide for Abraha's army. When Abraha reached near Taif, the Banu Taqif realized that they were no match to the invaders. Apprehending the desecration of the temple and of their idol, Lat, their delegation called on Abraha and offered to guide his army, if he spared their temple. Abraha accepted this offer, and the Banu Taqif's representative, Abu Rigal, joined the army as a local guide. At some distance from Mecca, at a place called Al-Mughammas or Al-Mughammis, Abu Rigal died. For a considerable time thereafter, Arabs used to stone his grave, thereby expressing their disapproval of his betrayal. They also taunted the Banu Taqif for their collusion with the invaders of the Kaaba in order to protect their own shrine to Lat. Muhammad ibn Ishaq relates that the advance contingent of Abraha's army took away the cattle belonging to the people of Tihama and of the Quraysh, including 200 camels of Abdul Muttalib, the Prophet's grandfather. Abraha deputed his envoy to the Meccans, telling them that he did not intend to fight them. His only objective was to demolish the Kaaba. He promised them amnesty if they did not resist him. He had directed his envoy to bring along with him the Meccan chief, if he was interested in negotiation. Abdul Muttalib was then the Meccan chief. The envoy conveyed to him Abraha's message. He replied, "We do not have the strength to engage Abraha. This is the house of God. If he wants, he will save and defend it." The envoy asked him to call on Abraha, to which he agreed. Abraha was struck by his towering personality and stepped down from his throne in order to receive him. He asked Abdul Muttalib if he could do anything for him. In response, the latter asked him to return his 200 camels, captured earlier by his army. Abraha replied, "I was impressed by your personality, but your reply has lowered my estimation of you. You ask for the return of your camels while you say nothing about the Kaaba, which has been for long your forefather's shrine." Abdul Muttalib retorted, "I am the owner of only my camels and request you about the same. As for the Kaaba, it is the house of God who will protect it himself." Abraha replied that his lord would not be able to so defend it from him. Abdul Muttalib then said that this was a matter between him and the lord. He then left Abraha, who returned to him his camels. Ibn Abbas's version, however, is different. It makes no reference to the demand to return the camels. According to Abd ibn Humaid, Ibn al-Mundhir, Ibn Murdawai, Hakim, Abu Nu'aym, and Bihaki, who all cited reports on this incident on Ibn Abbas's authority, when Abraha reached Al-Sifa, a place between the mountains of Arafat and Taif that is situated near the boundary of Haram, Abdul Muttalib called on him. Abraha asked him if he needed anything and regretted that he had come all this way to him. He also plainly told him that he was there to demolish the sanctuary. Abdul Muttalib reported, "It is the house of God. So far, he has not let anyone establish his authority over it." Abraha, however, reiterated his resolve to demolish it. Abdul Muttalib offered him anything he wanted on condition that he left Makkah without damaging the Kaaba. Abraha refused and ordered his army to advance. Without preferring one version to the other, it emerges clearly from both that the Meccans, including the tribes in the adjoining areas, did not have the means to take on Abraha's huge army in their bid to save the Kaaba. They did not, therefore, put up any resistance. Even at a later date, the Quraysh could muster only a 12,000-strong army on the eve of the Battle of the Confederates when they had joined hands with other polytheists and Jews in order to attack Medina. Clearly then, they lacked the strength to confront a 60,000-strong army. Muhammad ibn Ishaq relates that after returning from Abraha's camp, Abdul Muttalib directed the Quraysh to move to the mountains along with their families in order to escape being massacred. Then he entered the Kaaba along with some other Quraysh leaders, and while holding the handle to the door of the Kaaba, he supplicated to God, invoking his help to protect the Kaaba and its custodians. 360 idols then littered there. However, they abandoned these idols and sought only God's help and protection. Their supplications, as cited in the reports of the day, contain invocations to only the one true God. Ibn Hisham quoted the following couplets then recited by Abdul Muttalib. O God, man defends his house, so you defend your house. Let their cross and strategies not overwhelm your strategy tomorrow. If you leave us and them at our own, you are free to act as you like. In his Raud al-Unf, Suheli quoted this couplet as well. Rescue your children today against the children and devotees of the cross. Ibn Jabir in turn recorded these couplets as being recited by Abdul Muttalib. O my Lord, I do not expect anyone to confront them except you. O my Lord, protect your house against them. The enemy of this house is your enemy. Stop them from destroying your town. After making supplications, Abdul Muttalib and his men retired to the mountains. The next day, Abraha proceeded to enter Mecca. However, his special elephant, Mahmud, which he was riding, refused to move on. Though all attempts were made to coax him, it did not move an inch. Whenever it was directed to move in any direction other than that of Mecca, it moved at speed, yet it sat down when it was turned towards Mecca. In the meantime, there suddenly appeared swarms of birds carrying stones in their beaks and claws, which they pelted upon the Abyssinian army. Anyone who was hit by these stones quickly started to rot, the flesh falling away from his bones. In the opinion of Muhammad ibn Ishaq and Ikrama, it struck the army like smallpox. Such an epidemic was so reported for the first time in Arabia. Ibn Abbas describes that one hit by such stones developed an itch which led to the bursting of their skin and their flesh falling away. The other report by Ibn Abbas relates that the flesh and blood of those hit by these stones melted, bearing the bones. Abraha met the same fate. His body disintegrated, with his flesh falling away from its skeletal frame. These pieces of flesh rotted in no time. Panic struck the army, and they retreated towards Yemen and sought the help of their local guide, Nufail ibn Habib. However, he flatly refused, saying, "Where is the escape route for you while God is after you? Abraha, the split nose, lies subdued. He is not the conqueror." In the ensuing stampede, many died. Atta ibn Yasar clarifies that all the members of the army did not die then and there. Some collapsed on the spot, while others died as they fell on the way. Abraha, too, breathed his last on reaching the town of Khatam. The above calamity struck the Abyssinians at Muhassir, a place that lies between Muzdalifah and Mina near the Muhassab Valley. Imam Jafar Sadiq's account of the Prophet's farewell pilgrimage, which he related on the authority of his father, Imam Muhammad Baqir and Jabir ibn Abdullah, and which is cited by Muslim and Abu Dawud, is as follows. As the Prophet, peace be upon him, moved from Muzdalifah to Mina, he accelerated his pace while crossing the Muhassir Valley. Imam Nawawi explains that the calamity that befell the people of the elephant also occurred at the same point. It is part of Sunnah to cross this valley at a fast pace. In his Muwatta, Imam Malik reports that the Prophet, peace be upon him, said, "The entire Muzdalifah is fit for staying in. However, the Muhassir Valley is not fit." The following couplets by Nufail ibn Habib, cited by Ibn Ishaq, throw further light on this. "O Rudena, had you seen it, but you will not see what we saw in the Muhassib Valley. I thank God on observing the birds, though I apprehended lest the stones might strike us. All of them were looking for Nufail, as though I owed some debt to these Abyssinians." This historic incident soon gained fame across Arabia. Many poets composed odes in order to commemorate it. All these odes attributed to God's supreme power. No idol worshipped inside the Kaaba at that time is even implicitly credited with the rescue. Take these couplets by Abdullah ibn al-Zibara as illustrative. "Those 60,000 could not return to their homes. Even those who fled, including their chief, Abraha, did not survive. Ad and Jerhum flourished there prior to the appearance of the Abyssinians. God oversees his servants and maintains this place." Abu Qais ibn Aslat exclaims, "Rise and worship your Lord and anoint the corners of the house of God located between the mountains of Mecca and Mina. The one on the throne rescued you, and the hosts of that king repulsed them in a way that some lay on the ground while others were stoned to death." According to Hani and Zubair ibn al-Awam, the Prophet, peace be upon him, remarked, "For 7 or 10 years after this incident, the Quraysh worshipped exclusively the one true God." Hani's report is cited by Imam Bukhari, Tabarani, Hakim ibn Murduwai, and Bihaki, while Ibn Zubair's is recorded by Tabarani, Ibn Murduwai, and Ibn Asakir. The above version is endorsed by Sayyid ibn al-Musayyib's Mursal report featuring in Khatib Baghdadi's work on history. The year in which this incident happened is called by the Arabs the Year of the Elephant. In the same year, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was born. Hadith scholars and historians unanimously date this incident to the month of Muharram, and the Prophet, peace be upon him, was born some 50 days after this incident. Theme: in the light of this historical account, as one studies Surah Al-Fil, one readily recognizes why this cites so briefly the divine punishment meted out only to the people of the elephant. For this incident was then common knowledge among the Arabs. They realized that the Kaaba had been defended by Allah, not by some of their pagan gods or goddesses. The Quraysh chiefs had invoked only Allah for help. They felt so indebted to him that for some years they worshipped no one other than him. Hence, there was no need to reiterate these points in the surah. Only a brief reference to the incident sufficed to draw the attention of the Quraysh in particular and of the Arabs in general to the Prophet's call. It consisted only of urging them to worship the one true God while abandoning all other gods. Another lesson embedded in this incident for them was that if they try to suppress the Prophet's call, Allah, who has routed the people of the elephant, may afflict them with his punishment as well.